only 8% of the greenhouse gases come from agriculture. And if you look at just at livestock, it's about 4%.
It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
The World Food Center is based at UC Davis in California, and I'm fortunate to welcome the director of the World Food Center, Hermias Kabrab. And Dr. Kabrab, I welcome you to Farm to Table Talk.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I think, first of all, we need to get into some of your research. Maybe before I do, explain the World Food Center to people.
Sure. So the World Food Center is basically established to harness all the capability and the skills that we have at UC Davis, particularly outside looking into UC Davis, it might be a little bit confusing to find out who is doing what. And so the role of the World Food Center is to make sure that people who are looking to collaborate and to work with specific people in Davis that are doing food-related work and to harness that capability and to bring people together. So we have really three missions. One is to connect people. The other one is to convene. So we're convening, such as putting together workshops and symposia that are related to food. And the other one is communicating the science that's coming out of UC Davis.
Now, were you at Davis before you started this responsibility, or did you move to Davis?
Yes, I've been in Davis now for 10 years.
Before that, where were you?
Before that, I was a professor in Canada.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And so you're at Davis, you've got this responsibility. Now, I have to ask you, this responsibility means that you are bringing people together with lots of points of view. And I've attended a session. It's pretty interesting because it was about the animal-based or animal uses or animal food sources. And it's kind of controversial because on the one hand, they're saying that around the world, we do need to have more food. A lot of places should be consuming more animal source food. And some would argue that perhaps we have too much. And one of the reasons some people think we have too much and that we have to cut back on livestock consumption because of it is because of greenhouse gases. And particularly with ruminants that are producing methane. And so some that don't know much else about it than what I just said, and they could probably explain it a lot better than I just did, are saying, okay, well, this means that we have to slow down, stop consuming beef, for example, because of that, or dairy products because of that. Now, you've done some research that's looking at another way to tackle that problem, haven't you?
Yes. So I think, first of all, we can put this into perspective. And if we look at the U.S. or in California, only 8% of the greenhouse gases come from agriculture. And if you look at just at livestock, it's about 4%. Less than 4% comes from livestock. So we need to put this into a broader perspective. So it's not as big as some people might think in terms of the contribution of greenhouse gas emissions from livestock. But that doesn't mean that we should not be doing anything to reduce the impact of livestock on the environment. And to that end, we've been trying to come up with some solutions to reduce particularly methane emissions. That's enteric methane emissions. That is methane that's been produced by ruminants such as cows and buffalo and goats and sheep. So they emit it from their stomach because they are digesting highly fibrous feed. And so one of the ways we're trying to combat is using feed additives. And the particular feed additive that we're trying to use, we're doing an experiment on right now, is seaweed. And we found that a particular species of seaweed has the potential to reduce enteric methane emissions by over 60%.
Well, let's back up and explain what those emissions are. I mean, people feel like it's gas that animals have. They're actually kind of, most of it's coming from belching, isn't it? And it has to do with the fact that these ruminant animals have four stomachs, and like you say, they're digesting food that we can't use. And that's another important part of the story, because it's almost no way to feed the world in 2050 unless we make better use of all the land that can't be farmed otherwise, that's grazing. So you would have to use ruminant animals. So you're solving that problem by coming up with this feed additive. How did you find yourself to seaweed as being a potential solution?
So we've been looking for the different ways to reduce enteric methane emissions, some of it by changing the diets and things like that. It wasn't as effective as we would like it to be. Maybe you can get 5 to 10%, but not much. But then we saw this work that was done in the lab in vitro, and they looked at different seaweed. And they found especially one type of seaweed reducing methane emissions quite substantially, but it was done only in the lab. And so there have been other things that was tried in the lab, but when it was tried in the live animal, it did not work because those animals have very complex microbiota in their system. And so they were able to adapt to different changes that we're trying to come up with. But with this one, we saw that the mode of action was actually a little bit different and has the potential to be successful in real animals as well. So that's what got us interested, and we got in touch with the researchers in Australia. We got some samples. We replicated their work in the lab, and then we proceeded to do this work in live animals. So we've done the first test in dairy cattle last summer.
So these cattle would eat roughage of some sort, or the silage and or corn that you grind up and then just put the seaweed ground up into it too to feed them.
Yeah, so basically we use their normal diet. So it's alfalfa-based diet and some concentrate. So we don't change anything on their diet. So all we do is we use a bit of molasses to kind of mix the seaweed so that the seaweed sticks to the feed, and we just mix it with the feed. So it's just a little bit of seaweed with the molasses and top dress it into their feed. We mix it all up, and so they consume it with their normal ration. So that their ration does not change whatsoever. It's just adding a very small amount of seaweed.
So for a cow, there might be, I don't know how many pounds, a lot of pounds consumed every single day. And then the quantity that you're putting in of seaweed, is it like a cup or something equivalent, like per cow?
Yeah, so it's very small amounts. I would say maybe between 100 to 200 grams of seaweed per day.
I don't know what seaweed looks like unless it's wrapped around sushi. So what does it look like? So when you're getting the seaweed that you're going to be able to put into livestock rations for this purpose, what form does it come in? Does it come in bales or buckets or boxes? I can't even imagine that.
Yeah, so the way we use it is that once the seaweed is collected from the ocean, it is freeze-dried.
And
freeze-dried.
Oh, freeze-dried.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So once it's freeze-dried, then it's easy to crush it, and it just turns into powder. So if you look at it, it just looks like any powder. That's why we mix it with the molasses, and so that it helps us to stick with to the feed.
Does it have a taste?
Yes. I mean, as you can imagine, it's from the ocean, so there's a lot of salt in it. It's about 50% minerals. Mm-hmm. And that could be one of the issues, actually, because we see a little bit lower intake when animals were supplemented with seaweed, because it makes the whole food a little bit more salty.
Well, I'm going to show my ignorance here, because I can't imagine, how do you harvest seaweed? I mean, you can't just say, well, I'm going to get a boat and go out here somewhere and, reach down into the water and pull up seaweed, can you?
Yeah, it's pretty much like that. I mean, we actually hire fishermen that have boats, and they go out into the sea, and they may have to dive or just snorkel, and they pull out the seaweed from the ocean. And then, just put it into the bag in the boat. And once they come to land, they freeze-dried.
So you'd have to dive down. Is it pretty low in the water, usually, the seaweed?
Well, the red seaweed, the Asparagopsis, yes, you have to dive down a little bit. It depends where you are. In some areas in Australia, for example, it is washed out onto the beach, so we don't have to dive down.
Oh, you can actually just pick it up off the beach.
Yes, yes. But the volume that we need is not, we need a lot more volume to do some tests. So we actually have to do the diving.
Well, you know, there's a lot of ocean. I don't know, what is it, 75% of the landmass of the Earth is water. And so a lot of ocean. So I assume there's a lot of seaweed. So is this scalable? I mean, if this keeps working, how big of a problem is it going to be to get the quantity you would need to be able to include in rations to have this effect?
That's a great question. And to address that, we are working with marine biologists at the UC San Diego at the Scripps Institute, and they're trying to understand this particular species, how to grow it, understand the life cycle, and how to scale it up. So this work is going on right now as we speak.
Is there any other nutritional benefits for the cattle that would be consuming this, other than the fact they don't belch as much, so they're not producing methane, which is contributing to greenhouse gases? But is there any other nutritional benefits that they're getting from consuming seaweed?
It has some organic matter in it, but because we are providing such a small quantity per animal per day, nutritionally it doesn't really have that much of benefit.
This would help a lot of people that are feeling like, I really don't want to be cutting back so much on my meat consumption, and they've been feeling guilty because they thought they were contributing to greenhouse gases. So those people, and also maybe ranchers that feel like the demand is going to be down, are going to say, hurry up. You know, these things take a long time, and you're in the laboratory and you're finding something that might work. How long is it going to take? Ideally, to get to a commercialization stage where this is out here at some level that can be having an impact on what cattle are eating.
Yeah, I mean, the road to commercialization really depends on the level of investment. So we're trying to attract some investment to try to hurry up and get this done. And we've got some really good supporters from the farming community as well as from philanthropic areas. So we've got some support, and we're doing that. We are actually on our second trial at the moment, and so there is opportunity, and there's investment coming in. So we're hoping that, you know, in the next few years we'll be able to get it into a situation where we can distribute it and people can use it.
Well, the U.S. Department of Agriculture has made $3-4 billion that they put out for research. Is there any chance of some of that money coming to help with this?
I'm not sure if we will get any of that, but we will try. And, the state of California actually has a lot of investment in this area. We tried. We were not successful in the last round, but hopefully in the next round we'll be able to get some funding from the state.
I mean, is it possible that like a feed company would come in and say that they want to have the position that they, I don't know, they have a patent on a process or something like that?
Yeah.
That they invest money into it and commercialize it that way?
It's quite possible. I mean, seaweed is not the only thing that we are working on or the only solution. There is actually another feed additive that's close to market that is as owned by a company, DSM. So,
what's it made out of?
It's a synthetic compound. It's called 3-NOP. So it can be made from byproducts.
What kind of byproducts?
Like glycol. It's a nitrogen based feed additive. So that's
is it synthetic or is
yes,
it natural?
It has to be synthesized from different products.
That's interesting. So, if you the main issue with it has been ruminant animals. Now, of the ruminant animals, goats, sheep, cattle, deer, buffalo, do they differ in how much they produce, or do they all produce methane kind of relative to their size?
So, relative to their size, they're about the same. It's the the amount of feed they consume is really is what determines how much methane they put out. It's mainly because they are digesting their fiber. So how much fiber they are digesting is an indicator of how much methane they're producing.
So if they only ate corn and they weren't getting roughage, which is a waste, I think, with ruminant animals, but say if they only ate grain, would they not be belching as much and producing this greenhouse gas?
Well, they would still belch. I mean, you can't give them all grain because they get acidosis and they will die. But if you increase the amount of corn in their diet, you would reduce the amount of methane emissions because corn is more digestible than hay, for example. So yes, there is that, but there's always a cap of how much of corn you can include in the ration.
Well, and then the corn is produced on land that could actually produce something for direct human consumption. Even corn can be used for direct human consumption, mm-hmm. whereas the roughage that the ruminants are able to consume, really, it's the only way we can utilize it.
Yes, I completely agree. I mean, the ruminants, they evolved to consume roughages that we cannot consume. And so they really help us in upcycling of this material. And not only just roughages, but also byproducts. A lot of the byproducts in California, for example, cows eat about 50% byproducts. So all of that is being recycled and upcycled to convert it into high-quality protein and other minerals.
So when you talk about byproducts, what's an example of a byproduct?
A good example is almond hulls.
Oh, sure.
Almond hulls, you know.
Nothing else to do with them, really.
Exactly. If it wasn't for the dairy, it would have been taken to the landfill, and they have methane emissions coming out of the landfill. But
you know, I alluded to this at the beginning, but if you look at the whole world and look at the challenges that the people were, what, 10 billion people or something like that by 2050, is it nearly impossible to feed that many people unless you're utilizing all of this land that can only be grazed that you can't grow crops on?
Exactly. I think nutritionally, you can feed people with carbohydrates and stuff, but nutritionally, you really need to have animal source food in order to be able to meet the nutritional requirement of the 10 billion people.
Well, I think that the people are going to be very interested in seeing this work come along. And again, I think hope that you get you know, the funding keeps coming in and you're able to produce this. And someday, do you suppose that there will be some foods that are have been fed this, you know, the seaweed. Hmm. And so the animals have been treated, just like there's a market right now for people to identify foods that were organic or non-GMO and so forth. I wonder whether there will be a consumer interest in knowing that they're consuming meat that was produced sustainably because the ration included this that reduced their methane.
I would imagine so. I mean, I think there would be an interest from people to see products that have much less impact on the environment. I think that's definitely one of the ways. And the other thing is also, we have legislations like in California, for example, to reduce methane emissions by 40% by 2030. So
that's you gotta really get it in gear, don't you?
Exactly. So I mean, that's a huge reduction, and so that's going to push the farming industry to try to meet that expectation.
What else can they do other than, you know, what you're working on to be able to reduce it? Unless they just go out of business, what else is there?
Well, then, right now there is also investment in manure management. So the way you manage your manure, you can also reduce emissions that way using things like anaerobic digesters or other alternative manure management techniques. You could come up with some reduction
can
as well.
You explain that a little bit. We don't have to get very technical about it, but what a methane digester is.
Sure. So manure, if you leave it in a lagoon, which is a lot of dairies use lagoon, it creates an anaerobic environment, and that organic matter in the manure is converted into methane. So it just goes straight into the atmosphere. What anaerobic digester does is that you put all the manure into anaerobic digesters, and it will produce methane, but you collect the methane and you use it as a sort of energy. So you burn it off, you convert it into CO2, and so you really reduce the amount of methane that would have been produced. So that's one way to reduce methane emissions from farms.
Well, this is exciting. You're addressing an important need. It's a concern that people do have with climate change. And like you say, it's going to be the law in the state of California that we have to get this reduction. So I think everybody's hoping that the research keeps going well and you can keep moving it along. And maybe in a few years down the road, we can have this conversation. You're going to tell me about it's been successfully introduced. And we will have had a big impact on the methane and greenhouse gases because of being able to add this to ruminants' feed. So that's exciting. And just one kind of final, I want to circle back to the World Food Center, because this is one of those issues. You're bringing people together on this. As you look down the road these next couple of years, what are some of the other kind of issues you hope that the World Food Center helps put on the table for the community of agriculture research around the world to get their arms around?
Yeah, so one of the things that we're going to be bringing about is the issue of food waste. So there's a lot of talk about food waste, and actually, you know, we are already producing enough food for 10 billion people, but 40% of it is wasted. And so how do we combat that thing? So we're going to bring people together to think about food waste and how to address food waste. So so we actually open up to the faculty at UC Davis, and we ask them, we suggest what kind of topics that of interest that we can help them convene. And so this will be an ongoing kind of work, and the World Food Center will put out a lot of symposia and workshops in the future.
Well, if people want to know about events that are being scheduled at the World Food Center, or find more about the programs, there may be somebody kind of around the world. There's some I've met at your events that have come from literally around the world to attend sessions here at UC Davis from the World Food Center. But how do they find the information? Where do they go to learn about what you have scheduled?
Yeah, so we have a website. The World Food Center has a website, and also we have Twitter and Facebook, and so we use social media to let people what events are coming up.
Well, you know, it's exciting what you're doing, and I really appreciate your taking the time to join us on Farm to Table Talk, and good luck with this research. Hurry up. A lot of people are waiting.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.